I'm Nikki Kristoff, and welcome to Teched Up. We're still experimenting with a new weekly format, so this is an episode where a guest host and I break down what's behind the latest tech news. Today, I'm joined again by Adam Kovacevic, the CEO of the Chamber of Progress, and I couldn't have scripted a better guest for the news dominating headlines this week: antitrust and kids' online safety. Adam, thank you for coming into the studio again, second time this month. So today we want to talk about two things. We're talking about a new book written by social psychologist Jonathan Haidt. He has a theory that we should be banning kids from phones until high school. And then we're going to talk DOJ v. Apple.
Great.
Where we may not agree for once.
Great.
Which I think will be good.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with the book. It's about essentially the idea that smartphones, and specifically social media, is really, really harming kids, that there's a causation between social media and kids having more anxiety, more depression, more mental health issues. Thoughts?
Yeah. So first of all, I do think that there's a legitimate criticism of Jonathan Haidt's work about establishing the causation. And there's been other studies on this question of social media and mental health. And so just to kind of bracket that, we're not social science researchers here, so we're not going to get into back and forth about this. But let's just say that some of this is in dispute.
Yeah, the methodology.
Now, having said that, I think that what he's talking about is tapping into something real that a lot of parents, particularly of teenagers and preteens, are feeling, which is that, like, childhood's changed. Phones play a big role. Social media plays a big role. There's clearly a lot of feeling of, like, powerlessness on the part of a lot of parents. And it's just interesting to me to see, like, the way that's manifesting itself, because some of that is being turned into, like, we got to legislate. We got to do legislation on this topic. Our organization works on state legislation, and this is probably one of the biggest categories of state legislation just by volume. There's so many bills dealing with kids online, and there's a variety of different ways that particularly red states and blue states kind of tackle it. But what I'm interested in with Jonathan Haidt's book is that he is not necessarily calling for political solutions. He's calling for more like norms, right? And so his norms are like, you know, kids shouldn't have a phone until they're in high school. They shouldn't be on social media until they're 16, that there shouldn't be phones in schools that you know, should be locked up, and that kids should be playing outside more and doing more activities. I mean, I think about, like, our childhood, I don't know about you, but, like, television. I watched so much television.
Right.
Basically unlimited television as a kid, right? And at some point along the way, that became kind of, like, bad, right?
Right, right. At some point, we started thinking of screen time as too much TV. And there was actually a lot of hysteria around how much TV we were all consuming. I had a really, you know this, irregular childhood.
Sure, right? Sure.
So my parents, like, locked us out of the house starting at 7:30 a.m. in the summer. And we're like, come back when the streetlights are on. So
I'm kind of jealous of that. I mean, I was kind of a TV. No, I'm serious. I was a TV addict. I remember in second grade, me and my two best friends, we, for like an exercise, we charted, like, how we spent our time outside of school. We had the most TV watched and the most books read, but we just never went outside. And so I'm sort of like,
right.
And I don't know. So
you also had rickets.
Yes. Yeah, that. So anyway, so I do think, like, at some point along the way, this idea that maybe kids shouldn't have unlimited screen time became a norm. And, like, with our kids, you know, on the weekends, basically we let them have an hour after lunch and an hour before dinner, right?
Right.
There's some limit. And different families do this differently.
And before we get into how old your kids are, one of the things he says, which I sort of agree with, he says we are overly protective of kids in the real world and not nearly protective enough of them online.
Yes.
And that he suggests sort of this retro idea of how, more like how I grew up or people our age grew up.
Yeah.
I think he makes some good points, but I wanted to ask how old your kids are.
Well, they're 11, 8, and 5. So they're all in elementary school, middle school. And my oldest is the one we're agitating for this a little bit more. He's a boy, so he's interested. He's not as interested in social media. He's interested in video games and stuff like that. But I do think there's definitely a strong element of, like, what's the norm, right? So, you know, about a third of his class have phones, right? And a lot of people are on iMessage or SMS, and so there's a group chat for the class, and he's on that through his, through his computer, and I think that he feels like he's, you know, in on the kind of the group chat, right? Nothing of consequence happens at the group chat.
Right,
I've seen the group chat.
For 11-year-olds,
it's pretty dumb, but for 11-year-olds, it's exciting. A norm like that only really works if everybody adheres to it. And same thing with, like, video games, because, you know, a lot of video gaming now is kids not going over to another kid's house, but actually playing from their own house, but talking to each other over Twitch or some other service, right?
Sometimes they call each other.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's absolutely true.
They call each other on the telephone and then have it on speaker.
Yes. Oh, that's what my son does too.
Right.
And I think particularly for boys, that's kind of a lot of, I mean, not to generalize too much, but that is a big way boys socialize. I think girls might be a little more interested in sort of the social media part of it. And so, you know, like, even if you wanted to be the parent who's like, I want my kid to be outside, where are all the other kids?
Well,
they're at home. And so that's why this is really hard, because your whatever you want to do is somewhat influenced by what other parents are doing.
Right, exactly. You can't be the only parent who says you can't be on a phone or on social media, because it actually isolates the child.
Right.
They then don't have, there is not a group of kids running around the neighborhood together anymore.
That's
not a thing.
And so it's interesting to me, because I think some of this then it like gets channeled into this push for like legislation, right? So we've seen bills that say, you know, Florida has this new bill. You can't be on under 16, I think is where they ended up. Right now, you know, social media services, technically kids are allowed on by themselves until they're 13. A lot of parents are okay with their kids being on before 13. So they let their kids lie. They lie for their kids. That's pretty rampant.
Well, the kids can also do math.
And the kids can also do math.
I mean, it's not one of their great strengths right now.
Yeah.
Kids, but they can figure out how to have a birth date. That's
right.
Right.
So I it's interesting to me that like people are like sort of turning to the government because there's a collective action problem.
Correct.
I had this older friend. He said his daughter, when she got to high school, got really upset that she would go to a party and everybody would be on their phone. So she, the daughter, actually had this idea of, hey, guys, like, let's have a no phones party. And it turned out they loved it and actually had more fun doing it. But it actually started with the kid. It started with the teenager. It wasn't a law. It wasn't a parent mandate, you know. And so I do kind of wonder if, like, that's kind of the better path. Because, and also a lot of the bills that are proposed in this area, you know, they require age verification. That's very difficult. They've run into constitutional problems. There's a lot of, like, hurdles to this, to legislating in this area when norms might be the better way of approaching it.
Yeah, I agree. I understand that telling parents you should be stricter about bedtimes and screen time and like what I know nothing about this. But I am recently, I now have four teenage roommates, which is like a long story and a subject for another
separate podcast.
Whole separate podcast. 13, 13, 15, 17. Boys, all boys. And I think of myself almost like Jane Goodall. I'm curious about what they're doing. And the older boys are completely obsessed with TikTok. It's very addictive. It's hard for them to get off of it. And I think it's designed differently than other apps. It starts with the For You page. It sucks them in and they spend hours and hours on it. And then they're in bed later. They don't get as much sleep. It's very hard to take that away from them. They're also on Snapchat constantly, which is gamified engagement. So streaking, which is where you're, you know, every single day messaging with another kid, you get this gamified streak. So they're snapping all the time just to keep those streaks going. And then the younger two are on mostly YouTube, and they're mostly watching videos and they're doing gaming. I do think, and this is a point made in the book that we should address, it is slightly different for girls. So girls, all the, having been a tween and teen girl myself, all of the pressures to look a certain way, be a certain way, present a certain way are amplified by a factor of a zillion when you have social media. And so a very good friend of mine has two tween girls, and we went to the Taylor Swift concert, and the number of photos they had to take to get the right photos made me really sad.
I know.
Just the moments of their life. And so I think it's undeniable. The correlation is maybe it's not causation, but the correlation is so much stronger with girls in you know, UK, Australia, New Zealand, United States. It's very clear that they have more anxiety, more depression. That's why we're seeing so much legislation. Parents feel like they're at a loss.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. But I will say that some of the bills that you know, we're seeing, like, for example, in state legislatures this year, there's a bill there's a bill in New York and a parallel bill in California that says a service can't use algorithms to personalize a feed. Right. I think some of this comes out of the Frances Haugen stuff. They've sort of demonized an algorithm and they said, OK, well, you know, you can have a feed, but it can only be people that you've chosen to follow.
Right.
Expressly. And they're legislating this or proposing to legislate this. Well, the problem with this is, like, an algorithm could serve you stuff that's bad, but it could also serve you stuff that's good.
Totally.
And actually, it could serve you stuff that's even better than the sort of the chronological kind of raw feed, right? If you're interested in Greta Thunberg, right, and you could get, you know, served and recommended climate change activism content, right? And so you know, so it just, it seems to me like some of this is, again, very well intentioned, but taking on the wrong target.
Right. I think that's right. And I laughed when you said demonizing the algorithm, because I think that's happening across not just social media with kids, but across everything, right? Sure. The idea that the algorithm is controlling us. And actually, there is serendipity. I'm very pro-tech in general. I think there's a lot of serendipity on the internet, a lot of serendipity on YouTube and on Instagram. I end up, because of whatever triangulation they're using with Wi-Fi, anyone I'm near, I end up with like a new interesting set of recommended videos, which I find fascinating. And so you do learn more things. It's hard to control the content because it's just very, very difficult with that amount of data. It's not realistic. The government isn't going to fix this. It has to be. I think it has. Cecilia Kang was on this podcast. She had written a book about Facebook, and she said she felt like social media was quickly becoming like cigarettes. That people were just going to say, we're done. Like, this is not healthy. It's not good. I'm done. My kids are done. And that we're sort of careening toward that. And I think there's probably some truth to that. You disagree?
I disagree. Well, first of all, it's kind of funny for journalists to say this because they live on Twitter, as we all do, right? I mean,
right,
come on.
Right.
But also, look, imagine that you're, you know, a kid who feels somewhat excluded or left out, right? You feel like kind of an outcast, you know, maybe LGBT kids in a school where there's not many other fellow LGBTQ kids. Online communities can be a refuge for that kind of situation. I just hesitate to sort of paint it all with like it's all terrible, because I think for some people it can be a little bit of a refuge from a bad, you know, in-person community that they have or an unsupportive family. It's not to say it's all good either. I just hesitate to sort of exclude those kind of situations where it might be a refuge for people. But I see, again, with bills being introduced at state level, you know, a legislator introduces a bill and it's very broad and sweeping in its kind of mechanism. And, you know, we might sometimes come in and say, well, you know, do you know that it would actually have this unintended effect, negative effect that you probably don't want? And a lot of times the reaction is, well, you clearly don't care about children. And I think actually Jonathan Haidt in his book kind of does a lot of this, like gets to a better place where it's more of a constructive conversation about like, okay, well, what are, you know, what are the pros and cons of various approaches here?
We are largely aligned on this. Again, you're coming at it from both someone who's deep into the tech world and you have kids. And for me, it's just sort of, I do think I'm a little nostalgic for the way we grew up.
Oh, remember in college, we would, you know, leave messages on whiteboards in people's dorm rooms to, you know, stay in touch with them.
Absolutely. Well,
this is not a nostalgia podcast, however.
I mean, it kind of is because we're Gen X and most of the people who listen to this podcast are Gen X. but yes, it's not a nostalgia podcast. It's a future-facing podcast. Okay, which leads us to, actually, that was a segue that didn't make any sense, which leads us to, hard segue, the Department of Justice v. Apple. Apple is a partner of the Chamber of Progress, an organization you run. It'll be interesting to see if you and I agree on this one. We're usually in agreement. The United States is suing Apple for alleged monopolistic behaviors. What do you think?
Well, this one's interesting because in 2019, the FTC and the Justice Department basically split up big tech. And they said, Justice Department, you get Apple and Google, and FTC, you get Amazon and Facebook. And I think it's sort of inevitable that when you've done an exercise like that, you're going to end up with lawsuits because it's, you know, who spends all this investment looking at something and say, nah, I'm good.
Yeah, forget it.
Forget it.
It's a trillion-dollar company.
Eh. Exactly. So Apple was like the last one left not to have a lawsuit. And what's interesting about this one is there's always been some app developers who complain about Apple's terms of the App Store and the commissions and things like that. But those issues have largely been litigated through the private cases brought against Apple by Epic Games, which Apple mostly won. The judge was sort of reluctant to micromanage kind of what Apple charges on commissions. And so I think what the Justice Department ended up with is mostly a case that's really going after the vertically integrated nature of the iPhone with iOS. So the heart of it is that they're saying that basically the integrated nature of the iPhone deprives opportunities for what they call super apps, which are apps like WeChat in China, like American versions of that, cloud gaming. They say that could emerge as a competitor. And then they specifically take on Apple Pay, Apple Wallet, iMessage, the whole green bubble, blue bubble situation. And the last issue is watches. And so they're arguing that Apple makes it too difficult for non-Apple Watch watches to operate with the iPhone.
Wait, I want to go back just quickly so people understand. So super apps are kind of this idea of someone might have an app and then they want to have apps within the app. other apps within apps. It's, yeah. It's like controlling the app store content.
That's right. The best example of this is WeChat in China, which is, you know, an all-in-one social media, email, calendar. We don't really have an equivalent of this right now. You know, we might use the Gmail app and the Google Calendar app and Meta and Instagram and all these other things separately. In China, these have been combined, at least in WeChat. Their argument is that that could emerge as a competitor. And they argue that Apple, you know, has rules that prevent that kind of thing from happening. Apple says it doesn't. But it's interesting because we haven't seen this anybody try to do this kind of thing.
Right.
Now, they argue that people might have tried. What's interesting to me is that the people most likely to do a super app would be big tech,
right,
which would probably be criticized for doing a vertically integrated all-in-one app. But that one's a strange element of the case.
I do think that they've thrown everything into the pot that they could find potentially that where they're showing that Apple is forcing people to use Apple Watches, Apple Pay is exclusive to Apple, the App Store is completely constrained by Apple. And what they're saying is there's a worse consumer experience. So I like that they're focused on consumers. The Federal Trade Commission seems very focused on competitors, which makes absolutely no sense under U.S. law. Here they're looking at consumer harm. But I think that their point that therefore there is a worse product for consumers like belies what is obvious, which is Apple makes great products.
Yeah, I think we might disagree on the competitor versus consumer focus. I think like their effort to go after Apple Pay, like arguably the biggest beneficiary of that would be probably big banks.
Right.
Right. So in watch, yeah, okay, maybe consumers would benefit from that. But the one of the big challenges for this case is the existence of Android as
well,
a competing
right.
platform.
It's not a monopoly. Yeah. At a minimum, it's a duopoly.
Yeah,
like,
that's right.
Sure, nobody's using a Windows phone.
No. No, we're not talking about Windows. Yeah, we're talking about Android. And the thing is, like, Apple has, from the very beginning, had a very integrated experience with iPhone, very curated, walled garden. It's always been that way. There was never really a bait and switch. And it, you know, we were at Google when Google launched Android. And I remember thinking, like, what is this? What is this even going to be? But it's pretty clear, like, the strategy all along was for it to be like the mobile equivalent of Windows, right? To be the open, flexible, basically be like the alternative to the walled garden. And it's been remarkably successful. Interestingly, Android's more successful outside the U.S. than it is in the U.S.
Right. And it's incredibly successful. So Apple only has about 20% of the global market share.
Yeah.
They're saying they have 70% here. And then the DOJ did this thing where they're calling it like performance smartphones versus just like any smartphone.
Yeah. And for all these antitrust cases, the market definition is very gerrymandered.
Well, right. And I mean, because it kind of has to be.
Yeah.
Because that's the whole game.
That's the whole game. And then, you know, so you'll expect in this case, as in the other cases, that the government and the defendant will spend a lot of time arguing about whether the market definition is correct.
Right. So, okay, you are talking about competitors. I guess that's true. But one of the things they focus on is switching costs. You mentioned we were both at Google when we acquired Android. I started at Google the year the iPhone was released. I had this hot pink Motorola Razr, which I loved, and I actually wouldn't mind going back to. I got something called a G phone, which I put in my desk drawer and thought I'd never use, which was the prototype of an Android. And then I used Google phones for 8 years. I didn't get an iPhone until I left. And at some point, I thought, I actually kind of would like a Pixel. It has a great camera. I like using all of my Google apps in one place. And then the switching cost for me, which is not addressed in this litigation, but if I were doing this, I would have included it, is the goddamn cables. Like, my entire junk drawer is just like a yucca mountain of USB, USB-C, Lightning. None of it's interoperable. They got rid of the headphone jack, which enrages me. And so it's just like a giant pile of white cords. And I'm thinking to myself, if I get a Pixel, then I've got to undo this whole mess of wires. And I just can't deal with it.
Well, you know what's funny about this? We normally trash Europe, but Europe has now required the iPhone have USB-C.
Yes.
So you actually like something Europe has done on tech regulation?
I do. I think we should regulate interoperability of cords. And you know what? I think it's a popular issue. I would like to see it picked up.
This is your platform. Cord interoperability.
I have, yes, cord interoperability.
Yeah.
I think
okay, but set aside the cord thing.
Right.
How difficult was it to switch?
I didn't switch, and here's the other reason.
Okay.
I am sort of trapped with the hardware because I now have my headphones. I have CarPlay. Mm-hmm. You know, I am somewhat trapped, and I like my iPhone.
Right.
That's the other thing. I like it. I would love the option to switch to a Pixel, but it's just not worth it. And then we have to talk about it. And it sounds so dumb, and people are mocking the DOJ brought it up, but it is a for reals thing, which is the green bubble.
I've always had a hard time getting into the green bubble social trauma, but maybe maybe you feel closer to it. It's never struck me as like the basis for an antitrust complaint.
Well, it doesn't really make sense because it's not Apple hurting their own consumers. Yeah. And really the only harm to Android users is shame.
Yeah.
For having the green bubble. And there is a real
element. Apple argues that it's that iMessages are encrypted and SMS is not. That's what they're signaling to an iPhone user. But I get
literally no one knows that. Yeah. No one who's getting a green bubble thinks, oh, it's a warning that this isn't an encrypted message.
Right.
No one thinks that.
It is an interesting choice by the Justice Department to include that issue.
Yeah.
Just given like the way it's sort of been memeified.
Yeah, it's been totally memeified, but it is a real thing. I think we started this conversation talking about kids.
Yeah.
It matters to kids.
Yeah.
Kids do not want to be the person on the group message who's got the green bubble.
It's interesting, too, because in Europe, this is not an issue because everybody uses WhatsApp.
Right.
This is a uniquely American thing. And the interesting thing about this is Apple hasn't done anything in the U.S. differently than in Europe. So this is peculiarly American that we've ended up in this situation.
Right.
Where people, again, outside the U.S., people responded to this by like, we'll just all go to WhatsApp.
Doesn't right. matter.
This case isn't going to see a courtroom for probably 3 years.
Right.
And so you do kind of wonder, like, will some of these issues be moot by then? Will the DOJ amend the case to bring in new issues?
Right.
I mean, one of the interesting dynamics of these government cases against big tech is that the enforcers who bring them, Lina Khan, Jonathan Cantor, will probably be gone.
Right.
By the time the case is actually, brought to a conclusion. So that's just an interesting dynamic. So they're sort of they get the burst of headlines for launching the case, but then it's really probably implemented by somebody else.
Well, and I think the crux of it is people do have an option.
Yeah.
Sure, I may not want to deal with the switching costs and I may not want to have to export a bunch of my data and my photos. So it's a headache for me, but it's not because I can't. And in fact, if I did switch, I would save money.
Yeah.
There is another option. And the Pixel is a great phone.
Yeah.
It's a great phone.
But I always sort of like think about it like, I love going to Disneyland, sort of closed experience. And I also like going to Yosemite National Park. But I worry that the case is going to force Disneyland to look like Yosemite, right? And actually, we should allow both to operate.
Well, and not to put too fine a point on it, I think of this, and maybe this is a terrible analogy, but, everybody...
Analogy war.
Okay, let's have an analogy war. Yeah, you've got Yosemite and Disneyland. I'm going to go with a Tesla versus a Nissan Leaf.
Mm.
Like, nobody ever thinks about the Nissan Leaf, but it's the very first electric car. Nobody's posting their Nissan Leaf, like, to the gram because Tesla... is conspicuous consumption. It's a luxury good, right? And so, allegedly it has self-driving, although it's going kind of not that great for them right now. But it is essentially a luxury good. You're showing people you can afford a Tesla. It's cool. You're not seeing an antitrust case against Tesla over the market for vehicles because people have a lot of options, and they actually do have a lot of options with phones.
I think that's right. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out because all these arguments will get aired in briefs in court for years.
I think they probably, you're right, we'll have years to do it. Things will change over time. And I suspect it's not a winning case. Yeah. I think people are frustrated, but I think overall they like their phone and they do absolutely have options. Adam, thank you for being one of the co-hosts of this, coming in twice this month. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Sure. I think we've gone deep into chords, which has been awesome.
Yeah. And it's been sort of perfect timing. It's something you're really focused on in your day job and have been for many years. So the headlines sort of broke perfectly for this setup. And I'm really grateful you came in.
It's always fun.
That's a wrap. If this podcast gives life to your inner tech nerd, please do subscribe or leave us a 5-star review. Anybody listening to this show knows the algorithm needs to be fed, and I really want to keep it ad-free and independent. Tune in next Thursday. You can find video content on YouTube. You can find us on Instagram, or you can just follow up Teched Up wherever you get your content. Thanks for tuning in.